you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
I'm Austin Cross. Join me for LAist's new live event series with the James Beard Foundation. We Are Where We Eat will go behind the scenes of LA restaurants. The kickoff event is May 22nd. Tickets at LAist.com/events.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Every 10 years, a big scientific agency called NOAA compiles climate data from the past three decades to figure out how we're doing. California? Well, find out why the news is not great. Plus, it used to be the most color you'd see in a superhero movie was on the costumes and capes. Now, it's in the casts. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Hi, I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, and we are back for another round.
This is clearly an NPR audience.
Yeah, I think they're so smart. What the hell?
My guests this time are actor Vella Lavelle and author Amanda Montell, whose new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, is out now. Join us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum for book talk, trivia, and hot takes. Tickets can be found at LAist.com/events.
From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take Two. May Martinez, thanks for joining us. Coming up, top Hollywood talent agency ICM is facing backlash over what some are calling a toxic work environment. We'll get into that, plus an overview of some summer movies. That's just ahead. But first, yeah, it is getting warm out there. If you're wondering just how hot it's going to be this summer, well, we're not forecasters, but we do have some insight to share. Every 10 years, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, averages climate data from the past three decades to get an idea of where the country is weather. Otherwise. And the latest figures show that California is already getting warmer and drier. For more, we're joined by Michael Pilecki. He's a climatologist for NOAA and the U.S. Climate Normals Project Manager. Michael, welcome to Take Two.
Welcome. Thanks.
Now, the group of data that you use are called the U.S. Climate Normals. Can you explain what kind of information is calculated and how it's gathered?
Well, the original observations are gathered largely by the National Weather Service at their Cooperative Observer Network and their automated surface observing stations. We also gather data from several other agencies and groups. And we take this data, we quality control it, and then we do several other steps beyond just taking a simple average. We fill in missing gaps. We homogenize the data for changes that are due to movements of the stations, and we also take into account other factors to lead to a more complete data set and a better image of what's been going on for the last 30 years.
So getting as full of a picture as possible.
Yes, that's exactly true.
Yeah. So why does NOAA then track the U.S. climate normals, and what does the report actually tell us about our day-to-day experience of our climate in terms of weather?
Well, that's the normals are actually what's used by your broadcast meteorologist to tell you if your day is above or below normal in temperature, or last month was wetter or drier than it should have been. And so that gives you a context for today's climate. And it also gives you a bunch of additional information for people making decisions in various economic sectors.
Okay, so getting then to the latest numbers, what major changes were observed over the past 10 years across the country? Let's start with just straight temperatures.
Well, comparing temperature from the 1981 to 2010 period to the current new normals, 1991 to 2020, it's warmer across most of the lower 48 states. Essentially, only the north central states of Dakotas and Montana and Minnesota have a little bit of pushback against this. They're a little cooler than they were in the last cycle, but almost the entirety of the West, the southern U.S. and the East Coast are warmer. All of Alaska is warmer. And so we definitely have a very strong warming signal of anywhere from a quarter degree to a whole degree Fahrenheit across the nation.
Okay, so a whole degree Fahrenheit across the nation generally. What about precipitation?
Well, precipitation's a bit more interesting pattern in that the Rocky Mountains are a great divider between a drier west and a wetter east. Areas in the, especially in the Midwest and the Southeast, are wetter. Areas in the Southwest are drier, okay, including Southern California.
What about climate trends for the state of California as a whole? How are we doing here in California? That's where we're based.
Well, in California, you're largely in an area of warming and drying conditions, and that is true not only of the current normals period, but of the last normals period. So there's a trend that the normals are reflecting. Normals are not usually used to gauge climate change exactly, but they certainly are impacted by climate change, and they show the effects of climate change on our day-to-day climate that we experience now.
So fair to say that California is drier and warmer and than it was before, or that it was in the past few decades.
That's definitely true, especially in the from the central to the southern part of the state. That's especially noticeable. Los Angeles, LAX, for instance, you're drier by at least a half an inch of precipitation every year, and the temperatures average is warmer by 1 degree Fahrenheit for the annual temperature.
Well, that's kind of a bummer. I mean, it's not nice to know that information. I guess we've all known, I guess, living here, it feels that way. It's kind of felt that way for a while. How do you continue then to track climate in between reports? I mean, are you always looking at this kind of data all the time?
Yes. The National Centers for Environmental Information, where I am in at the Asheville site of that body, is monitoring climate on a month-to-month basis. In fact, we produce a U.S. Report once a month and a global report once a month to put the current conditions in context, point out extremes. We also track the billion-dollar disasters that occur in U.S. that are affected by weather and climate.
One more thing, Michael, really quick. You mentioned how North Dakota up there, they're actually not getting warmer and drier. What do you think accounts for that? Is it just because they're up there?
Well, it probably is due to the fact that climate change is driving not only just overall patterns of warming and wetting of the world, but also the circulation of atmosphere of the atmosphere. And so you get more cold air events coming in there, and you're going to end up with cooler climate.
That's Michael Pilecki, climatologist for NOAA and the U.S. Climate Normals Project Manager. Michael, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, we're going to stay with the new U.S. climate normals, but we're going to switch from NOAA, a big NOAA, to another NOAA. Noah Diffenbaugh teaches Earth Systems Science and is a senior fellow at Stanford University. He also joins us now for a look at how these new climate normals will start to impact Southern California. Noah, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
All right, so what do data sets like the climate normals teach us about climate change?
Well, you know, they're really one of a number of indicators that climate change is occurring, and that really the baseline is shifting. Global warming is just like it sounds. You know, the global mean annual temperature is going up. It varies from year to year and decade to decade, but it is clearly marching upward. We've had more than 1 degree Celsius of global warming so far, and that's reflected in a, warming around the world that varies, from region to region and from place to place. And these, what we see in these maps of the, those different 30-year periods of the climate normals is a reflection of that shifting baseline. And it also, you know, is one of many features of the of that climate change, and in particular, you know, it goes along with the intensification of extreme events that we're seeing not only around the world but here in California.
So when we project to the future, I mean, we're relying on this information from the past to project to the future. Is that how it works, and is that how reliable it is?
Well, when we try to understand the characteristics of climate change and the processes of climate change and how climate may change in the future, we really rely on these historical observations from the big NOAA, from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, both for understanding climate change here in California and throughout the U.S. and around the world. So this is one of the, you know, these kinds of long-term observations, long-term instrumental data sets are one of the pillars of understanding climate change and projecting climate change in the future. And of course, we combine these historical observations with a number of other data sets, including climate models, which allow us to understand the processes mm-hmm. that are shaping the climate change that's already happened and that are likely to shape the response to future global warming.
Noah, what are we seeing now that maybe we didn't anticipate decades ago because we just didn't have the information yet?
So I started my PhD studies right in the Y2K era, September of 2000. And at that point, you know, climate was, you know, in a lot of ways kind of thought of as this long-term mean. And there really wasn't, there wasn't a lot of research on, for example, extreme events. That research was just beginning. And there really was a barrier with understanding individual extreme events that, you know, that are, you know, that were unfolding, you know, day after day and year after year. And, you know, that's really changed in the last decade in particular, but starting with the European heat wave in 2003. So it was a real seminal study taking the leap to try to understand how the global warming that had already happened had influenced that really severe heat wave in 2003 in Europe. And since that was really a watershed moment. And now we have just hundreds and hundreds of studies along those lines. And that's, you know, really built the evidence that global warming is already impacting people and ecosystems through extreme events like the yeah. severity of heat waves, the severity of intense precipitation, storm surge flooding, the intensity of droughts, when low precipitation occurs, the frequency of low snow years, the frequency of occurrence of extreme wildfire weather, right? These are all
yeah.
areas where for California, we now have evidence that global warming is already putting a thumb on the scales and increasing the odds that we experience these high impact events.
So from the date that you mentioned, the date you got this started, September 2003, that was 2003, right? Or 2001? You said 2001, right?
So I started my PhD in 2000.
Oh, 2000. Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. But that's still just 21 years. That's a snap of the fingers, right? I mean, none of this was really in anyone's mind. And then over 21 years, all of this gets just squished into this tiny space of time. I mean, that's got to be a climate slap in the face.
Yeah, I think a couple of things have happened, and there's research on this, kind of retrospective research trying to figure out, where you know, scientists like myself included and a number of other scientists are going back and trying to evaluate what we published previously and how did we do, right? So you can go back and find papers even from the 1980s, as well as the 90s and 2000s and, you know, onward, projecting forward into the future. So, you know, for one thing, it's now been long enough since those original papers that we can go back and ask, okay, in this paper from 1988 that projected global temperature going forward, well, now it's 2020. Like how did that paper do in those intervening 30 plus years? I've done, you know, similar with, you know, the extreme event papers that my research group has published where I've gone back and said, okay, let's treat this like a prediction. We went on record in the peer-reviewed literature saying, you know, here's how we think, you know, here's how the data show that extreme events are changing, yeah. What happened in the intervening period, right? And so part of it is that we've just had more time.
Okay.
More climate change has happened. The observational records are longer, right? We've had more, more observations. And also I think, you know, the scientific community has really responded to what has been occurring in the real world, right? You know, it's undeniable that,
well, that's the key word, right? No, I mean, it's all this information that is at the very least tough to dispute, right? But people do dispute it. We're talking to a Stanford professor, Noah Diffenbaugh, about the impact of the latest U.S. climate normals. California, Noah, what does that potentially mean, warmer, drier California? What does that mean for those who depend on the land? I mean, should farmers worry about what and how crops can grow in this in the new climate normals?
Well, certainly we're seeing that long-term warming throughout California, and some of the effects of that warming are, you know, more frequent and intense heat waves, larger fraction of precipitation falling as rain rather than snow, earlier melting of the snowpack that does fall, and I'll just note that that's exactly what we're seeing. You know, those are the conditions we're experiencing right now.
Yeah.
With this widespread drought and really rapid melting of snowpack this spring, and you know the intensification of drought conditions when low precipitation happens, the associated increase in wildfire risk as a result of that warming and the effects of warming on vegetation. Also with precipitation, you know what we see when we look at these long records of precipitation observations as well as the atmospheric circulation. What we see is that California is now in a climate where the conditions that produce hot dry periods are more likely, but the conditions that produce wet periods are no less likely. And what that means is we're in a climate where we can expect these protracted warm dry periods, and including all of those effects on the snow hydrology that I mentioned.
Yeah.
But we still, those periods we can still expect to be punctuated by wet conditions. And in particular, intensity of precipitation we know is rising, and that because of that effect on the snow hydrology, we're now much more likely to get these kinds of extreme runoff events when heavy precipitation happens. We saw that in the Oroville crisis, and researchers at UCLA, for instance, have shown that global warming has substantially increased the odds of that runoff during a storm event like what caused the Oroville crisis. So global warming contributed enough to really kind of cause the threshold to create a crisis out of that precipitation event because of the effect of warming. And
the data is there then for an adjustment possibly for all of us that live here.
Well,
at least have that in mind.
Climate change now. I mean, I think that's, yeah, we, and that's, you know, you asked about how, you know, compared to 20 or 30 years ago, what we know that we're living in a different climate than the one in which all of our water systems and disaster management systems were designed and built. The question is, California's certainly been a leader in responding, and we're still experiencing impacts from climate change. So, really, to become resilient, we need to, it's clear we need to not just catch up with what's already happened, but jump ahead to be prepared for what's coming in the future.
Now, the U.S. has rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement. California aims to reduce carbon emissions, some very aggressive and ambitious goals that the state has, along with the Biden administration as well. But what would it mean for climate change if, Noah, we were able to reach those goals? I mean, will limiting global warming to, say, under 2 degrees stop all of this change?
Well, so limiting global warming to 2 degrees will, have a couple of effects. One is that it will, we'll get less intensification of these conditions than if we don't limit global warming to 2 degrees. So we'll get less at 2 degrees than we would at 3 degrees. But secondly, we'll get more at 2 degrees than we've had at 1 degree, right? And so when we look at these different kinds of extreme events that I've been discussing, you know, we've gone through and asked very carefully the question you're asking. You know, how does 2 degrees compare to 3 or 4 degrees? And how does 2 degrees compare to the present? And really both are true. Achieving that Paris target, achieving the, you know, the Biden administration goal of net zero by emissions by 2050, achieving the California policy goals, that will reduce the intensification of climate extremes in California. And it will also leave us with a more extreme climate than we have now.
We just need to listen to the data, right? That seems like a simple thing, but it's been difficult, I think, for some.
I think part of the challenge is really what we see in those climate normals, right? Mm. I mean, we really see when we look at those maps of the particularly the temperature normals, just that marching, that redder and redder and redder map moving forward. That's the shifting baseline, and that makes that does make responding to climate change difficult because we're always playing catch up, right? We're always this is a natural. We're not a stationary climate, and it's not trivial to respond to that because we're kind of constantly, even if we respond to the last extreme event, we're in a climate where unprecedented events are already more likely. And so it's actually not trivial to figure out how to leapfrog ahead, particularly with adaptation. I'll note that California has been a leader. We have for example, the Climate Safe Infrastructure Working Group that I was a part of, we were really mandated legislatively to look at how California's infrastructure design, investment, and management can try to make that leap. But it's a challenge for each of us individually as we go about our lives on a day-to-day basis. It's hard to do it at the state level.
Noah Diffenbaugh teaches Earth System Science and is a senior fellow at Stanford University. Noah, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
You can feel it in the streets on a day like this. Thank you. It feels like summer.
I feel like summer. More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
As a farmer's son from a desert region in California, J.B. Hamby thinks a lot about water.
I spent a lot of time digging up history, particularly about water, which is the origins of the Imperial Valley.
How this 28-year-old became the youngest lead negotiator on the Colorado River ever, and how he could shape the most consequential negotiations to date. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water dealmaker, wherever you get podcasts.
Start your Saturday with something that will grow your kiddos' brains and get their creative juices flowing. Join us at LAS for a morning of multilingual story times, interactive performances, art making, and lots of kid fun. Bring the whole fam and join us for a super fun Saturday at LAS in Pasadena on June 1st. Tickets at las.com/events. See you there.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. For much of the last year, Governor Gavin Newsom has been encouraging California schools to extend their school years and add instructional days to their calendars to make up for lost classroom time during the pandemic. Now, to that end, state lawmakers recently approved more than $6 billion in reopening aid and gave schools the option to spend it on longer school days or years. Here's Gavin Newsom at a press conference last month.
We no longer need to be tied to an agrarian calendar. Use this money to extend learning opportunities, extend the school day, extend the school year. Reimagine it for the kids, for your children, for our future.
But in the LA Unified School District, the governor's idea has been a bit of a tough sell. And this week, the school board decided to approve a normal calendar without an extension. KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes has been following this story. Kyle, before we get into what LAUSD's board decided, is there any evidence that a longer school year helps?
Yeah, there is evidence that a longer school year helps, and it helps especially for students who are at the most risk of failing. That's according to research that sort of distilled, you know, the findings that we've had in research studies over the years. And what they found is that for the average student, it at least doesn't hurt, but it is especially beneficial for students who are what the researchers say are at most risk of failing. So low socioeconomic students, for students of color, for students who have struggled in the past in school. And you just think about the students who don't have stable internet at home, who are potentially in a chaotic home situation. That research plus the thought that those are the students who are probably most likely to have fallen behind while distance learning was in effect. Providing makeup time for that is what state lawmakers and the governor have proposed doing, among other remedies, but extended learning time has gotten a lot of public billing from the governor, as you hear from that press conference, as a way to combat a potential backslide in academics throughout the crisis.
Now, there seemed to be a division, Kyle, within LAUSD about what to do. What groups, though, were generally in favor of adding more days to the calendar, and why do they feel so strongly about it?
Well, I mean, you have to start with the district's leadership that I think is in tune with that research. They've cited the fact that there is a research base to extend the school year as a justification for looking at a longer time in school. Superintendent Austin Buettner was very much in favor of this. And around the same time that clip came out from Governor Newsom proposed extending the school year. And even as the school board voted this week, said that there really just is no substitute, in his words, for longer days or for a longer school year in terms of providing extra time in classrooms as a way to make up for the pandemic. So that's one of the strongest constituencies that we've heard from is the school district leadership itself. There were also parents at this week's school board meeting of students with disabilities. The services for special education students have been, I think there have been mixed experiences by parents whose students are in that position, that some have been able to access their services in person, some have not. And for those who have not been able to access their services in person, an extended school year, in addition to what you already get as a special education student, I think had some upside for them.
So, okay, remind us, Kyle, what the plan was to extend the school year and why ultimately did the district decide not to go through with it?
So the plan was to initially what Buettner proposed was add 10 days to the school year in the upcoming school year. So 10 days taken away from the upcoming summer break and added on to the beginning of next school year, and then 10 more days added on to the second semester from winter break. This was met with a sort of tepid response from parents. Parent surveys showed that a plurality, in fact, preferred no changes to the school calendar. I think a lot of folks felt that their students were just burned out. So the district proposed a compromise of adding just 3 extra classroom days on the tops of each semester to try and add a little bit extra learning time, and then add 4 more days of teacher professional development. But what ultimately happened at the end was that the district, after putting out this compromise plan, also released survey figures from the teachers' union and the principals union, and both United Teachers Los Angeles and Associated Administrators of Los Angeles, even more of them than the parents, they were most staunchly opposed to the idea of extending the school year. And because it would have triggered negotiations with those unions, because we're so late in the process, we're already several months past when a calendar is normally approved for LAUSD, and the negotiations would have likely been contentious given that opposition. I think the district sort of had to retreat away from the idea of doing it, at least for this year.
Yeah, Kyle, I might know 1 or 10 or 30 parents who are quite happy not to extend the school year. I think they want a break to regroup. But, you know, that's just my my network of LAUSD parents. Kyle, any sense of whether other school districts in the region will add go ahead and extend the school year?
It's not clear whether other school districts, I mean, I don't have a great like region-wide sense of what this looks like. And part of the issue here is that the funding that the state is giving out, and I do think it's fair to say that the governor has been particularly interested in extending the school year. He even was proposing that we should have extended the current school year by ending summer break back in 2020 early, because that was where we were at in the beginning stages of the pandemic. But at the same time, there are other ways that this money can be used. There's other potential uses for the aid funding that state lawmakers have approved. This is $6.6 billion for pandemic relief aid for K-12 education across the state, and that it can be used for. It could be also used to lengthen the school day within the confines of the normal calendar. And so like there are a lot of different ways that the money could be used. So even though the governor has given top billing to the idea of extending the school year, other school districts are considering a lot of different ways of how to spend this money. And at this point, it's not yet clear how they're going to spend this massive windfall of not only state aid, but federal dollars that are coming in from the latest federal coronavirus relief package as well, that are aimed at trying to bring things back to normal as vaccines go in arms and we prepare for the fall semester.
Yeah, I was wondering how LAUSD would use money. I know, you know, the state lawmakers have approved funding that could be used for longer school years, but I was wondering how LAUSD might use some of that money. So no sense yet on where that money's going to go.
Well, some of the money could go to extending the school year at individual schools. Oh, the school district has talked about creating a sort of a need-based funding formula to distribute some of this money to schools who are interested in extending their school years on their own and just not instituting any district-wide changes. The money could also be instrumental if they want to extend next school year, which is a proposal that most school board members on Tuesday said that they were interested in doing. And most of the school boards of the district's administration is interested in pursuing a calendar year extension in 2022-23. So that's one possible use for this money. But, I think that there's a lot of ways that the money could be spent in addition to that going forward.
You know, Kyle, since we're talking about the coming school year, I mean, any sense of what that's going to look like? Or I think are people just want to take a break right now and not think about next school year?
Do we have to talk about this now? Right. Yeah. What Superintendent Austin Buettner, who is of course leaving the school district at the end of June, has said that he expects the school district to return to full-time in-person 5-day-a-week instruction coming up in the fall. That's what the governor has called for. It's not clear what the public health situation is going to look like in September. So I think, we've heard from particularly from the teachers union, not to rush to any judgments about what that's going to look like, especially in Los Angeles. But as far as I just saw figures that came out from the state recently that say that 86% of the state school districts are either reopened fully in terms of, like 5 days of in-person instruction, or at least for hybrid instruction at this point. So I think we're moving closer to a point where in-person instruction, at least partially, is going to be the norm. It's not hard to imagine things moving toward a 5-day, full-day calendar come the fall.
One more thing really quick, Kyle. I know nerves are frayed right now, but the school year won't be longer, at least in the next school year. What about in the future? I mean, any chance this idea creeps back?
I think especially because that money has a long tail, there's definitely a chance that this creeps back. On the other hand, this was derailed by not only teacher opposition and principal opposition, but there was a very vocal plurality. You could say maybe a minority, a plurality of parents in LAUSD who are not interested in changing the calendar. Changing the calendar has been tried before. before in the district. There was, you know, a couple of years ago, it was whether we should start before Labor Day, and you can divide any room, whether you on the question of whether, you know, it's too hot in certain parts of LA Unified to hold school in the month of August. So I mean, there is interest in revisiting the idea of a longer school year. Jackie Goldberg, for one, said that she's interested in a 200-day school year, which would be a full 4 weeks longer than it currently is. But changing the calendar is no easy feat, even in non-pandemic times.
That's KPECC's Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
More Take Two coming right up. Stay with us.
LAist has a new live event series with the James Beard Foundation. We Are Where We Eat will go behind the scenes of some of your favorite LA restaurants to find out how and why they do what they do. I'm Austin Cross. Join me for the first event where we'll explore how restaurants help make a neighborhood, and we'll all have something delicious to eat afterwards. It's May 22nd at the Crawford. Get your tickets now at las.com/events.
I'm LA's senior education reporter, Mariana Dale.
The communities that are more marginalized or that do not have access are the ones that are in most need.
I help families understand, navigate, and engage with the forces that shape education from kindergarten through high school.
How do I explain to my daughter that the same day you gotta celebrate a birthday, you gotta celebrate the day your mama left?
And I make space for students to tell their own stories.
LA'ist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Now, even before the pandemic, there was evidence that hunger was a problem for some of the military. There was a 2019 survey by the Military Family Advisory Network that found one in six families in Virginia struggled to get enough to eat, while another Pentagon study found that a third of students in its schools were eligible for free or reduced price meals. And now, during the pandemic, because some military spouses lost their jobs or had their hours cut, more pressure has been put on household budgets, requiring more families to rely on food banks and emergency aid to get by. From San Antonio, Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project, a collaboration of public radio stations, including KPCC.
On a blustery spring day at Fort Sam Houston, a line of cars idle with their trunks open, waiting as volunteers unload boxes of food from a semi parked nearby.
I'll pull up his trunk. You want to go head in?
Some of the drivers are soldiers who have just gotten off work. Others are military spouses or relatives.
So we're moving the cars now.
As they roll forward to collect their rations, most barely crack their windows. Volunteers say that's common because people don't want to be seen.
How are you doing? Good.
One of the volunteers handing out food is Army Staff Sergeant Rebecca Hummer, who's still recovering from tough times brought on by the pandemic. Though she makes just over $60,000 a year, including allowances for housing and food, Hummer still felt the effects when her husband Dale lost his job as a security guard in November.
He was looking to get hired, but because of the pandemic, there were layoffs, so he wasn't able to find work immediately, and we did face some financial stress.
On top of that, the couple had two huge unexpected expenses. Their house flooded after a heavy rain, and their dog was diagnosed with cancer.
It was hard. My husband and I, we save, but we had to kind of cut back on what we normally get as far as choosing either boxed items at the grocery store, a lot less fresh produce, things that were maybe less nutritious. So it was kind of a challenge as far as eating to get by, but that's what we did. And I'm not proud to say, but I skipped meals.
According to a survey from the military support organization Blue Star Families, more than 40% of working military spouses reported losing their jobs during the height of the pandemic. Others had to reduce their work hours, usually to take care of kids who were home and in virtual school. Many are still not back to work full time.
We saw a lot more, I think, job losses amongst spouses of military service members because, you know, child care became an issue.
Christine Abraham is the director of culinary wellness at the Fort Sam Houston Resiliency Center. She says lower enlisted families have been hit especially hard by spouse unemployment.
For the enlisted service member, to keep them from being food insecure, that second income is what made the big difference.
It's difficult to gauge just how many service members are food insecure. Josh Protas is the vice president for public policy with Mazone, a Jewish response to hunger. He says most food banks don't ask questions about military status.
Those agencies really try to protect the anonymity and the dignity of those that they're serving.
Still, he says many of those same agencies anecdotally report that more military families are using their services because of COVID-19. And Census Bureau surveys have shown increased rates of spousal unemployment and economic hardship.
I'm not sure that we have an exact statistic about food insecurity, but we know that it's been increasing.
The Defense Department is aware of figures from outside groups which show food insecurity increased during the pandemic, but it doesn't have reliable numbers of its own. It adds that it's planning on collecting data specific to food insecurity through surveys of active duty spouses. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Used to be the most color you'd see in a superhero movie was on the costumes and the capes. Now it's in the casts. Coming up are the first Asian and the first Muslim superhero movie characters in big blockbuster films. And with Captain America leading the way now, the first black Superman is on its way as well. Hear all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Haro Ale is our love letter to Los Angeles. We'll tell you where to get a yummy torta, a bowl of congee, and of course, a burger.
It's a beef sausage blend, fried egg, grilled onions, and then raspberry jam.
What hiking trails to check out.
This feels like we're out in the mountains.
And where to take in some culture.
Limerick Park, they've been fostering jazz for decades.
LA's a big place with a lot going on, so we got you. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. Abby Martinez. When it comes to Hollywood, change tends to come slowly. And when it comes to harassment, maybe not at all. Plus, superheroes of color. Yeah, that didn't used to be a thing way back in the day. It used to be that they'd be on the costumes, maybe on the capes. But now, yeah, the casts. For more on this and more, let's go on the lot.
Hey, shut up! Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is here, senior editor for film for The Hollywood Reporter. All right, Rebecca, International Creative Management, ICM, founded in 1975, has since become one of Hollywood's top talent agencies, Spike Lee, Samuel L. Jackson, Regina King, Shonda Rhimes. Now, while ICM claims that since 2017, half their agents promoted to partner are women and that over half of their departments are run by women, Rebecca, what's the other part of this story?
Well, this is a story published in the LA Times today that says they spoke to more than 30 former and current ICM employees who described a hostile work environment for women and people of color there. They talked about harassment, bullying, inappropriate conduct. And the story says that since 2017, nearly a dozen women have reported allegations of mistreatment by male agents there.
Allegations. What allegations are made against ICM?
Well, some of them are really egregious, like an agent exposing himself to a female film finance executive. Some of them are unwanted advances. There's an unwanted advance described between an agent and a female client. And some of it is yelling at employees, degrading language, throwing things at subordinates. I have to say, while ICM is the agency that is covered in this story, I suspect that people who work at agencies all around town will see some things in the story that feel familiar to them. unfortunately, this isn't very unusual in what has historically been acceptable behavior at agencies.
Yeah, degrading language, throwing things at subordinates. I mean, again, I've said this a million times, Rebecca. You know, Swimming with Sharks, that weird movie that apparently is just exactly what happens inside a Hollywood establishment. All right, so who are the people being accused at ICM?
Well, the CEO of the company, Chris Silberman, is accused of setting a tone of sort of permissiveness in the company culture. There's also a partner, Eric Horan, who resigned after accusations of unwanted advances, which he apologized for. Another partner, Steve Alexander, was alleged to have exposed himself. He's denied that. There are sort of allegations all through the company of different crude and derogatory comments made by male agents and male leaders at the company.
Rebecca, what happened when ICM wanted to film an agent trainee program, and it was during Black History Month? That was 2019. What happened then?
Well, this the company was wanting to, I guess, portray itself as inclusive, but there were so few people of color in the agent trainee program that Black assistants were asked to pose as agent trainees. They pushed back at that. Ultimately, the Human Resources Department apologized, and that footage wasn't used in the final video.
So basically, Black people as props.
Yeah, sort of tokenizing of the few Black assistants who were employed there, and there was an effort to make them appear to have more power at the company than they ultimately had.
What has ICM said over all of these things?
The company issued a statement saying it, quote, does not tolerate harassment, bullying, or other inappropriate conduct. HR investigates all reports received and addresses each with appropriate disciplinary measures up to and including dismissal.
You know, Rebecca, you've been covering this for a while, and I know we've come a ways, since 2017, but obviously not far enough. But I mean, is change noticeable to the point where it's getting better, or is it just pretty much all the same?
I think what's happening is that there is a new expectation of transparency at companies. So a lot of the behaviors described in this LA Times story about ICM actually predate the sort of Harvey Weinstein 2017 Me Too movement. But people are starting to talk openly about these kinds of things now. I think the story that my colleague at The Hollywood Reporter, Tatiana Siegel, did about Scott Rudin has also inspired some people to talk more openly about different kinds of harassment and mistreatment apart from the sexual misconduct. And I also think that younger employees have different expectations. They're not as willing as generations that came before them in Hollywood to kind of put up with abusive treatment from bosses.
Yeah, grinning and bearing it. That doesn't quite fly anymore. All right, from talent agencies to entertainment journalists, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, they're trying to reinvent themselves. Rebecca, remind us of what happened and what they're hoping will now happen.
Right. I mean, this is a story we've been talking about since the LA Times story in February, which revealed there were zero Black journalists out of the membership of 86 in this organization. That sparked, threats of boycotts from Time's Up and over 100 PR firms if the HFPA didn't show some reforms by May 6th. Well, now the HFPA has written a letter to its members asking them to approve this sweeping set of reforms. They're proposing adding 20 new members with a focus on recruiting Black members. They would like to eliminate the residency requirement that calls for members to be based in Southern California, and also open it up to members who work outside of print.
And if these reforms are not passed, what might happen?
The board would resign.
Ooh, wow. All right. So there's some teeth then maybe to what they're at least proposing. We're talking to Rebecca Keegan, senior editor for film at The Hollywood Reporter. All right, Rebecca, look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's not Michael B. Jordan. No, despite rumors that he might be the next Black Superman, Rebecca, it doesn't mean that the next Man of Steel won't be Black, will it?
No, Warner Brothers and DC are committed to bringing the first Black Superman to the screen. This is a movie that's being written by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and the studio is looking for a Black director to helm the project. It's produced by J.J. Abrams. There are a lot of, potential big directors who could be in the running for this. Maybe Regina King, maybe Shaka King, who directed Judas and the Black Messiah. But there's a real priority on having a Black director in the director's chair. As far as the actor goes, it's possible that they could cast an unknown for this. Yeah. As you said, Michael B. Jordan said, you know, he's not in this film. He's just watching from the outside. But there are a lot of young actors who are potentially in the running.
Makes me wonder, though, what's Michael B. Jordan working on that he would turn down being the first black Superman?
Well, I mean, he currently is working on a movie directed by Denzel Washington. That's sort of a serious drama. Oh. He's in this new Amazon movie, Without Remorse. I mean, he's working steadily. Sometimes being part of these big franchises is more than people necessarily want to sign up for.
All right. The Denzel Washington. Okay, fine. Go ahead and do that, I suppose. Right. Rebecca, it's not as if DC can wait too long, though, to fill the job of director and Black Superman, because Marvel, its arch nemesis, also has a project in the works that might be filling some of those same roles.
Right. Marvel's making its Blade movie starring Mahershala Ali. And they, too, are looking to have some Black creative talent behind the scenes as writers, as directors. So there are a number of projects now, superhero projects specifically, where the industry has really gotten the word that audiences want more diverse stories, and they're trying to populate them.
And in case anyone is wondering about Ryan Coogler, he is not available. He is working on Black Panther Wakanda Forever, the second Black Panther movie. So Ryan Coogler is definitely out of the equation. But that brings us, Rebecca, to Marvel's Phase 4 movie slate that picks up right after Avengers Endgame. And they released a sizzle reel of what's to come. So what's to come?
Yeah, the reaction to this sizzle reel in social media was a lot of people saying, okay, I now see the movie that's going to get me out to theaters after sitting at home for a year plus. There are 10 films. The first up is Black Widow, which comes out in July. Then there's Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, which will be the first to have an Asian actor leading a Marvel film. That'll be followed by Eternals, directed by Best Director winner Chloe Zhao, Best Picture winner Chloe Zhao, starring Angelina Jolie, Salma Hayek, Kumail Nanjiani. And then in 2022 comes the Black Panther sequel. There's just a lot in the pipeline.
There's a lot. And the great thing about it, too, is that there is, I mean, for anyone that grew up in this era that I grew up in and seeing all white people doing all these superhero things, now it seems like Hollywood, at least in this respect, Rebecca, has gotten the message. In Captain Marvel, Brie Larson is back as Captain Marvel. It's going to be called The Marvels. But in that movie, you're going to have a Pakistani-American character, Marvel Comics' first Muslim character. And when you think about who's running this thing, you mentioned 10 films, 3 directed by women, and the cast is full of diversity. I mean, that is the whole point, right?
Yeah, although, so we're waiting for Blue Beetle, but still waiting for a little more Latino representation, as I think you've noted.
Yeah, that's my only, I'm glad to see what's going on, but yeah, the brown folks still don't have much to say, hey, that's me on the screen, but that's coming. I'm hoping that's coming.
Yeah, particularly underrepresented when you look at how Latino moviegoers tend to go to more movies than other groups. So it's surprising that Hollywood's taken a while to catch up to that.
I am still, even though I don't like wearing capes, Rebecca, I am very available to wear a cape in any superhero movie that any Hollywood studio wants to cast me in. So how about that?
Okay, if anyone's listening right now, I hope they'll follow up on that.
One more thing really quick. Netflix planned to release Zack Snyder's zombie thriller, Army of the Dead, exclusively in theaters before it heads to the streaming service a week later. What led to that decision, Rebecca?
Well, as you may recall, 1,000 years ago in 2019, Netflix released The Irishman and Marriage Story exclusively in theaters before its movies came to their streaming service. At the time, Netflix's short theatrical window was off-putting to major theater chains, and they refused to screen the company's movies. This time around, a major chain, Cinemark, has booked this movie on 200 of its screens. So there's been a shift in power during the pandemic, and Netflix is now able to work with at least one major theater chain.
I can wear a big giant A on my chest and have a... that's Rebecca Keegan, senior editor for film for The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
On second thought, I can't wear the cape. I just can't wear a cape. I think superheroes with capes, it's just useless. The cape doesn't do anything. Batman, okay, yeah, Batman uses his cape. But every other superhero that wears a cape, it's just a big waste of time. All right, no more nerding out on capes and superheroes. If you missed any part of Take 2, just head to wherever you get your podcasts. Take 2 is back tomorrow at 2. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time.